Hello, I'm Katie.
And I'm Leslie.
And we're all booked.
Welcome back to another episode of Sterling Municipal Library's podcast, where we talk to you about the books we'd like to recommend.
And we have two guests on our show today, our frequent flyer, Kevin, who is the one of the assistant city managers, and then a first-time visitor or guest is Lionel. He works in our human resources department and has seen so much stuff over the years.
Yes.
But anyway, they are here to talk about the book White Fragility, which Kevin is the one who started all of this. So I want you to open by telling us how you found this book.
Well, thank you for asking, and it really is a great opportunity to share with you today. I'm glad we're going to dive into more meaningful, topical topics such as this, and I'm really glad to be sharing the mic with Lionel, who he and I actually talk about these things fairly frequently, and I've really enjoyed getting to know him in a different context as well. So for me personally, we have an annual conference with the International City Managers Association, and our conference was virtual this year because, like so many of the things with COVID, we didn't have an in-person conference. And so I was going through the topics that were being presented, and one of the keynote speakers was speaking on the topic of white fragility. So, you know, as a white male, I mean, that topic grabbed my attention, you know, white fragility, not sure where she was going with that one. So I figured I had to go check that one out, and I found the discussion to be very eye-opening for me. For me, it wasn't offensive, it wasn't someone poking and prying, but it was kind of opening up the world to say, are we willing to have good, valid, topical conversation, even when that conversation can be uncomfortable or unusual, or we're not used to doing that. And so starting from there, it spurned off into a smaller group of Texas city managers who then had a panel discussion, again, on the book, on the topic. And most of the professions of Texas city managers are white males. So it was very interesting to have white males getting together. And there were some females in there. There were some blacks and Asians. There were some other people that were involved in the conversation. But it's like we've all expressed at this point, are we willing to open our minds and our hearts and have conversations and see where those conversations lead us?
So who do you think is the main audience for that book? And do you think the author successfully reaches them?
Well, I think the primary audience is white people, to at least have a different view of the discussions of race. That's always an uncomfortable discussion for anyone. Yes. I know when Kevin first approached me with openness to talk, for those that know me know I don't have a problem with sharing my views, but it took a minute to understand what was the conversation, where was he coming from with the discussion, and then after it came across as authentic, I said, okay, well, this is an opportunity to have a conversation. And so it went on for months now, I guess it's been, which for me has been really an opening experience.
So at least in Kevin's case, the author did a good job of reaching their audience.
Part of the reason I wanted to ask that question is if you go on Amazon, the book is very polarizing. There are a bunch of people that give it 1-star reviews and a bunch of people that were like, oh my gosh, this is one of the best things I've ever read. I've needed to be challenged in this area. What do you think were some of the main complaints with the book?
Yeah, I think we all can be overly sensitive, thin skin. She's talking about me. She doesn't really know me. I have history. I think I'll just speak for myself. I think as a white male, all too often we can become overly sensitive since we don't usually have a lot of discussions about racism. And I think she does a good job of saying, why don't we? Because we're always in the majority. You know, I've never had an issue where I didn't feel included or I haven't felt belonging and part of the group. And so I think she does a good job of talking about, in generality, the majority that I've experienced. So even as I've talked to Lionel about the time I lived in high school in Forest City, Arkansas, which really is a small town of 12,000 people, and it is 50% black, 50% white, and there really isn't anything else other than black and white there. So I had an inkling at a point in place in time of where things were pretty equal. But she does a good job in the book of saying, but globally, that's not the case.
Right.
So I may have an experience in Forest City, Arkansas, where, like she said, there is no such thing as reverse racism. I mean, that doesn't exist, because I may experience a point in place in time where I'm not the majority. But as soon as I step out and I look globally at the United States and how things are represented and how policies are made, I am the majority all the time.
Right. So she covers a whole bunch of heavy-hitting topics. Do you want to talk about kind of the book in general, or do you want to start looking at some of the topics that she brings up?
Lynell, where do you want to go?
The heavy topics.
Okay. All right. Is there a particular one that she brought up that you want to talk about a little further?
No, I'll let you go ahead and leave that.
Okay. One of the ones that I found really interesting, because I read through the book, I got at least 50% of the way through, and I will finish it eventually. I'm slow.
it's a heavy book.
Yes. One of the topics that I found particularly interesting was she talks about colorblind racism and why it is problematic. Does anybody want to kind of talk
about
that
off with her
bit?
Definition of it.
It's more that whole, I don't see color, I look more at people for their achievements rather than, you know, other identifying facets.
And as a defense that people use,
yes,
when someone, yes, may bring up the topic of race or racism, they say, well, I don't see race. Instead of saying that racism exists, they just say, well, I don't see it that way, though. So
for me, that was a good topic of, there were several parts of the book that were just eye-openers to me because, again, I don't consider myself a racist. I try and be pretty broad-minded. But what she kept bringing up is the unintentionalness,
yes,
of a lot of things and how we say certain things and don't really mean anything by it, but how it would be perceived by, say, Lynell very differently than what I would say. So even in the Army, I think I brought up a point. I used to carry an OD Green tent pole in my boot, and I used to tell soldiers, I don't see color, I see OD Army Green, I see soldiers. My idea of saying, hey, we're all representative of being soldiers. But the book was pretty clear to say, no, but when I see Lynell, I do see a black male. And to say otherwise would to undermine the achievements and the culture and, mm-hmm, and the things that he represents or others would represent.
Yeah.
Me, in my way of saying it, I thought I was saying I'm trying to be inclusive of everybody, but I'm not sure it's always taken as that. What do you think?
No, I agree. I have a history with prior employers of diversity training, and that would always be one of the comments that one of the white participants would say, well,
yep,
I don't see color. Well,
yep,
how can you not?
Yeah.
Our society is built on that. It's built on identity. Who do you identify with? And there's always this perception of what group are you coming from, except for white people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. White people are perceived as not a group, but all other groups are, which is ludicrous,
I mean,
at the end,
mm-hmm,
of the day. So to not acknowledge that I see color is in denial of your existence and your everyday life walking around. You see color. You address it in some form or fashion. You respond to it because we all have that. We all carry those kinds of hidden biases that we don't recognize, mm-hmm, or acknowledge.
And even if some person could magically be completely neutral, saying that you don't see color really denies that that person has been affected in their life by the color of their skin.
Right.
Exactly.
So even if you're not treating them differently, you're denying the fact that other people do and that the system as a whole does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what I was hoping Robin was doing was speaking to us readers, particularly white readers, to evaluate what we do, what we say, and am I willing to be open to conversation? So I don't always know how Lynell or others would think about that. Am I willing to ask him, well, what do you think about this? I'm used to saying this. What did you just hear? Because what he hears may be very different from the thought I was trying to convey. And so, mm-hmm, are we willing to have that conversation?
And another interesting topic that goes kind of hand in hand, and maybe I should have started with this, was another theme throughout the book is about what white fragility is and what it actually looks like. And that includes like these unspoken rules for conversations about race and different defensive mechanisms that a lot of white people use, mm-hmm, to shy away from talking about it at all. Can you think of some examples that she provided in the book of what white fragility looks like in action?
Well, I guess the funny one, I have one of those. You know, it kind of the way I look at that, you know, so as soon as you tell somebody and, you know, and it starts to sound like, are you a racist or let's just say racism sounds, you know, so heinous or so,
yes,
hard. Let's just say we all have biases and prejudice because, mm-hmm, we all do. I mean, we're all raised a certain way. And so we all have biases. And so if I say that I'm not a racist because, you know, I've had black friends before. or I've gone places where I've had one of these, or we had a group and I had one of these. In fact, Lionel and I always talk about A&M because, you know, that's a good thing. And of course, I assume that, you know, the Aggie Brotherhood is, you know, we're all this. But it's interesting to have this conversation and talk of, you know, when I went there in the late 70s, there weren't very many blacks. There's not many blacks at A&M right now.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like spanning the classroom and you go, okay, well, there's one.
Right.
And we've talked about,
and so we're inclusive because we have one.
We have one,
right.
You know, so that's kind of how we talk. And so this book has gotten me to wonder in my conversations with Lionel. I've actually reached out to a couple of my black classmates to what was your experience at A&M? And again, what they describe is very different from mine, and it's around this issue of they weren't included.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, for any white person to, most probably can't, but to look back in your life, when was there a time when you were the only person that looked like you in the room? And where was the comfort level for you? More often than not, if you ask a white person that question, they can't answer because it's probably never happened, primarily because wherever they go, that's primarily who the people are. Restaurants, wherever, college, unless you purposely place yourself in a position where you're the only person that looks like yourself, and then you recognize there's going to be a different perspective because you're not going to have the same perspective as the larger group. And
right.
So that has an effect on how you perceive things that are happening.
I will say that happened once to me. I worked on a newspaper in part of my school, and it was my freshman year, and I was covering a memorial service for someone who was employed at the school. And I walked in, and I realized I was the only white person in the entire room, and it was more that they obviously all knew each other. Like, they were obviously very close and, like, a community. And it felt very odd to be, especially because I was a reporter, so I was, like, writing stuff down and, like, talking to people. It felt very weird to be, like, a fly on the wall, like, of this, like, very close community that I clearly didn't know. Like, I didn't understand how they were related to each other, like, how they knew each other, or even the person that they were celebrating that day. So it was this very awkward feeling of feeling like I'm invading their space almost,
right.
Which isn't the same because of the event that I was at, but it was definitely eye-opening for me, I think, to realize, like, oh, this is how it can feel when you walk in the room and other people are clearly connected by something that you are not part of.
Mm-hmm. So I told Lionel of the one experience we had, and of course we took it in a completely different direction, which is probably the nature of my life.
Right.
I'm usually trying to laugh at something. So my first sergeant at Fort Hood lost his 13-year-old daughter in her sleep one night, and so there was a rather large funeral that was for her. And so my wife and I went to the mass and then the funeral service, and it was all the attendees were black except for us. And someone from the family was filming it from the front of the church, so they had a camera that kept going back and forth, just kind of scanning the audience. And so we were laughing the whole time because we kept saying, you know, when that camera comes across us, everyone's going to be wondering, who's those two white people in this church? And so we didn't really kind of see it for the moment that it was and have the epiphany that you had, Katie. We just thought it was funny. Probably not the response I was supposed to have, right, Lionel?
No. Well, and I think as a society, we really get bound in these tribal mindsets of who do we belong to, how do we behave, who are our friends, and those friendships and relationships have an indication of our status in life often. And I'm always looking at opportunities to meet all kinds of people in neighborhood, at church. As they say every Sunday, if you look around everyone in your church, if there's no one in your church that looks like you, maybe there's an issue with where you are in order, you know, maybe you want to look at bringing more people that are different from yourself into your congregation.
This kind of leads a little bit to the idea of, like, systemic racism versus individual acts of racism, because if you are working in a community, I think it's very natural human instinct to try to work to better the people that you know. And if the only people you know are people who are exactly like you, you end up with people in positions of power working to improve the lives of the people that they understand and not necessarily the lives of everyone. So how do you think that differs? Like, looking at racism as an individual versus the idea that even if you work hard, there's still this system in place that is perpetuating racism with or without the individual acts of the people.
From my perception, where we are now, you mentioned there were a lot of people that were reading, primarily white people, that are becoming more knowledgeable about where they are in society. But it's such a split within our society of who's fully engaged to understand what does our American history look like in comparison to what we've all been told.
Right.
And there's almost a, for white people, differences where some white people are on one side of, well, I need to understand why things are happening the way they have been. I don't want to keep hearing what people tell me. I want to know by my history. So the only way to do that is through research. And then there are those who have decided that I don't want to know, and don't tell me and leave me alone. We don't have time to discuss all of this.
Especially, there's almost like this frustrating, people feel like racism has already been defeated when clearly it has not.
Right, correct. After Barack Obama was elected, well, we're in a post-racist society. Well, no, clearly not.
Literally the day after he elected, right. He was elected, you could probably tell very easily that we right. were not in a post-racist
yeah. you know,
society.
It's a good thing that, mm-hmm. that happened, but
yeah.
it's you can't erase 300 years mm-hmm. of past systemic racism. I mean, there are federal laws on the books that hampered continued development for black people or people of color. So to dismiss that is not acknowledging our history. You got to know why that happened, where it came from, what made it go away, because it may have gone off the books, but the practices never stopped.
Right.
I mm-hmm. remember I was telling Kevin the other day how it can manifest itself in so many parts of our society. I had a friend, he and his wife, other side of Houston, were looking to sell their home, so they wanted to get an appraisal. And so most people would think, okay, well, go ahead, go through your mortgage lender, get your appraisal, and someone would come out, appraise your property. That's what you'll use as your selling point. Well, no one knew that who they would send out would be someone who would appraise their property almost 25-30% less than their neighbor's property. And so they complained to the mortgage lender. Mortgage lender confronted the appraiser and found out that's what he was doing with homeowners of color.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Because he told them, well, what you going to do? Because he knew he could go somewhere else, and because he was certified as an appraiser mm-hmm. for the state of Texas. So, you know, it's those kinds of behaviors that happen. People don't know about it, and people think that those kind of things can't have an impact, but mm-hmm. just within that system, it can.
Yeah.
I like the story because, you know, you can get so hung up and almost defeated by where society's at that, you know, for me, I always try and start with myself. So mm-hmm. I read a book, and it's human nature, I guess, to read a book and say, boy, I hope so-and-so read that because, you know, they really need to know that.
Yeah.
And I try and read and be pretty self-reflective about where am I in it. So I'm on my own journey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy for me to talk to Lionel. I've talked to him over the years. But this was an opportunity to talk about different kind of things and delve a little bit deeper. Because so much of the Army is black, very easy for me to reach back into my past and have similar conversations with people I was very, very comfortable with. So the more I did that and saw that it was actually a very good exchange on both sides and I got to learn more, it's now very easy. I think I told Lionel when we went to Virginia for Thanksgiving, I was sitting next to a young black gentleman. And so I just started a conversation about this, asked him if he ever heard about the book White Fragility. And just my lead in now is I know that I'm probably never going to see, hear, or experience the things that you have in your life. And I'm just very interested in what you've gone through. Would you be willing to share? And I've yet to find anybody who's not willing to have that conversation.
Right. And I think in my experience, white people are the ones that are the most uncomfortable with having a conversation. And I've had all range of reasons why, everything from not knowing what to say, how to say it.
Right.
Or fear of they may have said something that was maybe out of bounds in the past, and during a conversation it may come up. The only way for there to be comfort level within groups of people is to have conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we'll continue to operate both sides of the track, and until such time, we won't get any better. One of the things Kevin and I talked about was, how did we get here? Because George Floyd, for example, wasn't the first black man that was
right.
killed on the
mm-hmm.
street. even in on TV, you know, in some form or fashion. But I think the pandemic and the fact that everyone was focused to stay at home. You can't leave. You got to sit at home and watch TV. And so in mass, everyone had to watch George Floyd video, explain it to their children. So at some point, you cannot run from that anymore. But, you know, again, George Floyd wasn't the first.
Right.
And so when you ask black people, if a white person says, how do you feel? Most black people will say, I'm tired.
Yes.
I'm tired of seeing it. Nothing's done. Don't want to have any more conversation about it, because until we decide as a society to do something, nothing's going to change. So the pandemic did have a positive effect on, at least it's making us acknowledge and recognize coming to a racial reckoning. Don't know if anything comes from it. You know,
right.
We'll see.
One thing I'd like to ask y'all as white women, as a black male, I mean, Robin DiAngelo, white female, I also think talking primarily to whites, I could even internalize in saying mostly white males is, I think, who she's talking to, because if I look at the reviews that you talked about earlier,
right,
the people that are most defensive are white males, and they make no bones about it. So I may have asked you this before, but I'm curious to y'all's thoughts. Do you believe that Robin DiAngelo honestly believes everything she wrote in the book, or is some of it shock effect to stimulate conversation?
Not being a white person, you know, I have a different perspective.
What do you think?
I think some of it is to generate conversation. So some of it was driven by, you know, using your term, shock effect, to get white people to become more authentic in their look into history, how their behavior impacts their surrounding. The one thing that always came up for me was this whole mindset of individualism.
Yes.
And how I was raised this way. I don't know why there's always this conversation with black people, so to speak, that things are unfair. My life was unfair too. Yes, no one can't deny that there are some white people who are raised poor, have less opportunities, but at the end of the day, when you look around and you see who's managing the bank, who's the president, who is the council member, who is the governor,
movie producer,
who, yeah, right,
yeah,
you know,
who our richest people in the U.S. are,
journalists.
Right. And so at some point, you can't deny that there is something that's affecting why black people aren't in these positions, or people of color aren't in even a third of these positions. We're talking in probably 10 of our top industries, 95% of them are run by white people, mostly middle-aged white males who went to Texas A&M.
There you go. I'm going to assume that you,
right,
considered me middle-aged, and I want to thank you for,
right,
that.
Right, right, right. And, you know, and so to have a conversation with one and they not step back and say and acknowledge there were other things at play that got them to where they are. It wasn't just because of their exceptional skill, or, you know, they were articulate in their ability to think in a strategic manner. There were other things at play. More often than not, whoever was in the position that they applied for, or that they obtained, looked like them. And so that plays a part in how our American society operates. And so to say for a black person that if you just work hard and you can get ahead, it's not true.
Right, I mean, right.
Because if we're the only way to be focused and able to change how we move forward, we have to be authentic and honest where we are now in order for us to be better.
What do you think, Leslie? I mean, as you read the parts that you've read, how did you take?
For me, this was not the first book about race that I've read, so a lot of the concepts weren't that unfamiliar or challenging. I wouldn't say it's a book that you just pick up and read for funsies on the beach, but...
Right.
What about a bottle of wine?
Yeah, maybe. That might be good. the parts about individualism really hit home for me because I hear that a lot whenever I hear people who haven't tried to investigate this kind of work as closely or haven't been willing to examine it. That is one of the first things that they will turn to, is talking about people on individual merit rather than looking at racism as a systemic problem. But I think one of the more challenging areas for me is when they start talking about ways to move with this work. Like, okay, we've done this intellectual work, we've learned about it, we've learned about the problems, now what? And it is still difficult when you have that family member that makes comments that you know aren't right, mm-hmm. to have the courage to stand up and be like, no, that's actually not a good way to talk about it. Let's dive into that. Or, you know, you're generalizing unfairly or things like that.
And when you're talking about that, the generalization, that's the part about the book that I liked when she said racism isn't a yes or no, like it's a switch you flip on or off. It's this continuum. Again, back to the point that we all have got prejudices and biases. So it's where on this continuum of how we live, how we talk, and how we express things, where do we lie? Because we all have got some elements of bias and prejudice. It's not a yes or no question.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I did really appreciate in the final chapter where she talks about a comment that she made that made someone else uncomfortable and some of the work that she did to rebuild trust and to apologize. And I felt like that was a really important way to wrap up the book, was to say, yes, we're going to mess up sometimes.
Yeah.
And we need to be willing to own up to it and examine ourselves and try to figure out how to not hurt people any further.
Yeah, but you have to acknowledge it, though.
Yes, absolutely.
And that often is the challenge for white people, is to have an open conversation about, if I said something that was offensive to you, can we talk about it?
Right.
And most black people won't have a problem with it if the person that's coming to them is coming in an authentic manner. But if they're coming and approaching with this guilt mindset of, well, you know, the only reason I said it was... And, you know, if you hadn't looked at me that way.
Okay, so those are both things I've told you, Lynell. Right. I mean, talk about some other people.
Right. And so, you know, you got to be honest in order to, it's not any conversation, but the conversation around race is a difficult conversation for white people. The only way to resolve it is to have one. Kevin will pull up people and walking down the street. You know, some black person, random, he'll pull up on his bike or if he's walking by them and have a conversation. I would venture to say probably 99% of them will stop and have a really authentic conversation about the way they feel and the things that they wish that could be changed in society. Because no one has probably asked them that. No white person has asked them.
I've not had a single person not be willing to have a conversation that I've started. They usually give me the look, as Lynell described. They're surprised I've started that conversation with them.
Right.
But they're absolutely willing to have the conversation. The value to me of a Lynell and others in the Army that I've talked to that I think know me better than most people is hopefully you have that trust thing from the start. I mean, I think you used the word authentic. I really am trying to understand. And more so for me, my hope is that as we continue in the future, and Lynell and I have had these conversations, we'll continue to have them, I'm apt to say something wrong or inappropriate, or he hears in a different way than he probably thought I intended. But then he can come back to me and say, you know what I just heard you say? Which would be great conversation, because I think it's back to that unintentional thing.
Right.
I mean, I talk a certain way, I process a certain way, but I probably don't always think about how others hear what I say.
Mm-hmm. Can I share an example?
Absolutely.
So it's been a couple of weeks, and Kevin came in, and we talk about a lot of stuff.
Right.
So it isn't just
always... We're going to keep most of it off air.
Right. And, you know, it was more about conversations surrounding how people handle racial conversations. And he was referencing a conversation he had, with another assistant city manager. And he was describing the experiences that black people have had. And he was equating severity to experiences. And he mentioned... Well, the experience that he was referring to was about a confrontation, but nothing minor like being followed around in a store.
Right.
And so And so my response to that was, well, for you it may be minor, being followed around the store, but that could be a traumatic experience for, it was for me as a middle schooler. And so he owned it. He said, you're right. So acknowledge when those moments happened and don't take it personal. It's all about perspective and how what he may, because he probably looks at that from his perspective as a white middle-aged male that, well, that's probably a minor thing. You know, it's not as severe as you being pulled over or something along those lines. Well, but him hearing that just by him perceiving that as a minor, that's, you know, from my perception, it's not.
Right.
Because it can have a long-lasting effect on your own persona as a person. That whenever you're a grown adult and you go into stores, even if it becomes secondary, it's still demeaning in that I can't be trusted by white people, the establishment, because I look like a black male that's coming in to do something wrong. Well, I have money. I have a credit card. I'm a customer.
Right.
So,
well, that's why I hope that the book challenges all of us to have deeper conversation, because it was hard for me to not read the book and feel like Robin was poking me several times. The conversations I have with Lionel, and even the story he just related when he kind of opened my eyes to kind of how I said things, because I trust Lionel and the conversations that we had, I didn't take what he told me as him poking me at all, because the trust is already there. So I think that's the bridge from the book to somebody I don't even know who, wow, that's kind of an interesting way she put that. But when you put that into practice and you start talking to people with an honest desire to know and understand, because I do want to understand what Lionel thinks and what he goes through. So when he comes back with something I've said, I don't take that personal at all. I just, you know, we've built up that trust. And I think that's where I hope the book leads other people to.
Yeah.
Start having the conversations, start trusting in other people, and then you can get a little bit deeper in the conversation because you won't feel defensive or threatened.
And not only that, just be willing to listen, which is another really important component.
And be willing to admit when you're wrong and not take it as like a challenge to your character. Just as long as you're willing to have those conversations and improve the way you're acting. One thing that this book and a lot of other books talk about along this line is it's not just good enough to work against your own feelings, you have to actively be anti-racist, which is a word that has been very popular in the past year or so.
Yes.
Specifically, how do you think things like this book talks about, can be applied in your everyday life? Conversations, of course, but what other ways do you think white people could be anti-racist? I think that's important to actually have a deliverable at the end of a book like this.
Well, words are one thing and actions are another. And it's easy to talk, but if your talk never becomes action, you know, back to Lionel's point, we've got a long way to go in society in general, because we can't approach some of the things we're talking about until policies change, until action really happens that make things more equal for everybody. But for me, it's something that you said, Leslie, it's when we hear people saying things, the jokes, the comment, the inappropriateness, are we willing, am I willing to stand up and say, hey, I don't want to hear that. That's not appropriate. That's not, you know, are we willing to do that? Am I willing to do that? And that's one of the things. And of course, and expect that people aren't going to like that.
Yeah.
Because again, you're probably going to hit their defense mechanism. Unless you've had a series of conversations with them before, people are going to shut down and they're not going to want to hear that. So, but we have to be willing to, first and foremost, hold ourselves accountable and then start holding others accountable when we hear and see things that are inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Know your history.
Yes.
You know, the thing that always surprises me, coming from Virginia, for example, I remember going through high school history, and there would be a blurb about slavery, for example, how, and the information that was displayed in the text was completely wrong. It lacked the milestones that accurately described what America's history was.
To include Rosa Parks' story.
Right, to include, right, to the whole Rosa Parks. I have my son, I remember, it's been about, so he's 30 now. Showing my age on So I remember him coming home talking about their discussions about Rosa Parks and her being, the reason she gave her seat up was that she was a frail black woman and she just decided she was just too tired. Well, that's not true.
She was 30-something, right?
She was 30-something. From everything I've read, she was the third person that they were, meaning the column, the resistance. The whole campaign was designed to focus on the bus boycott itself. And so they selected three top people. She was just one of the third person. She intentionally got on the bus. Mm-hmm. She was 30-something years old. She was not this elderly person. But that's why it's important, even in our history books, that we tell the truth. I remember probably 5 years ago when there was this, all of the discussions in Texas about the information that was being placed into the textbooks that are going to come out in 2022, 2023, mm-hmm. that was that information accurate? And so sometimes there is a political slant on the information, yep. mm-hmm. that's in the history book. But we are consciously teaching our elementary, middle school, and high school students information that is intentionally not correct. And so as an adult, you should take it upon yourself to know your history. We live in the most information-shared age in history. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason why you can't go ahead and find out that information. Once someone knows the information and you know why when you were raised there are no black people in your neighborhood and you wonder, well, mommy, how come there are no black people live here? There is a reason. And mm-hmm. so that's a conversation you can have with your mom about or dad about why they chose to live there and be open and honest. Once you become more knowledgeable, you can't help but do something to act on that. More often than not, most white people will. But the only way you're going to know is if you find out your history.
And not so subtle plug here, we do have a lot of really good books about that, too.
Not only that, but we have some fantastic librarians who I'm sure would help you find appropriate sources.
And we were talking about that just the other day, both the books and the quality of our librarians.
Right. There we go.
Yes. They're exceptional.
Hit us up. But that goes out to everyone. I know it can be hard because there's so much information out there to find the well-researched stuff that is going to give you a full history. Because even now, I think if you pick up a few books, they won't include a lot of things that aren't well known because of the way that they reported at the time. Mm-hmm. But if you get the right books, you can actually get a more in-depth look at some of these things and a wider array. I remember I listened to a podcast about the Black Panthers and all of their, like, morning breakfast programs for children and, like, and all of the stuff that they were doing. And I was just like, wait a second.
Right.
No one ever told me that they were doing all these after-school activities for kids and, like, fundraising to, like, help inner-city kids who just didn't have access. And it was just mind-blowing to me that even, like, if you tried, I think, to find information, unless you found the right source, you wouldn't see that stuff because people in power in the publishing industry are white people.
That was my next comment.
Yeah.
Is who are the people that are creating this information? Who controls the marketing of it?
Mm-hmm.
Black people. At the end of the day, when you look in the publishing industry, I think even newspapers.
Yeah.
Recently, over the last probably 6 months to a year, there were a number, especially when all of the marches were happening,
mm-hmm.
there were a number of individuals who were reporters whose responsibility was to write what they saw, but they were pushed in one direction or the other by whoever the editor was of that. I mean, some of the larger publications in, you know, both online and the minor print publications, but mostly be online. And some of these reporters just quit. They said, well, mm-hmm. if you won't allow me to report what's actually happening on the streets, but to report what you want me to report, that's a different slant, I'll resign. If I remember correctly, there was a reporter in the Memphis area that resigned mm-hmm. because of it. And they did a GoFundMe page to help him pay his rent.
Wow.
Because he took a stand. So
isn't that a challenge with the media in general, though,
right
now? Because whether we're talking newspapers or TV, their business is readership or viewership.
Right.
And so too often it's caught up in the sensationalism, what's going to drive a story or someone to watch it.
Right.
It's very difficult to watch TV and actually get truth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's why you even see those graphs out there kind of showing like political bias in reporting and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
it is difficult.
And on top of that, there's like a level of, especially when you get into things that require a lot of graphs and percentages, there's a level of like literacy that you need to be able to understand how to process data.
Right.
Like if someone says like, oh, 1,000 people showed up in the streets, but you're talking about like New York City, that you're like, that's nobody.
That's
a normal day on the street. So you really have to be able to like understand and put in context. And I think a lot of that is lacking for people. Like, I think it's hard for people to take that information in on their own and figure out where it sits.
Well, you bring up a great point. You know, being a finance guy, you know, we were taught early on, depending on the story you want to sell, you just play with the scales
yep.
that are on the graph, because I make that graph either steeper or level
yep.
depending on how, you know, I can do it by ones or I can do it by 10,000s.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make that line be whatever I want. And it can look either horrendous or, oh, that doesn't
stable,
look so bad.
Very yeah, stable.
Sure.
But yeah. Is there anything else that really stood out to y'all when you're reading the book that you think you'll carry away longer than the other things?
For me, I've read excerpts back in 2013,
mm-hmm.
and I remember as I went through the book, okay, I remember that. But there are a lot of experiences she shared that we like to describe as maybe she's someone that's woke to what's happening around them and able to take feedback in an appropriate manner. She still struggles.
Yeah,
and
right.
We all do. It isn't just white people that struggle. Black people struggle every day. There are terms we use called code switching.
Mm-hmm.
Where you are.
I'm going to have Lionel do this in my office someday. I just can't wait. We're going to set somebody up.
The way you have conversations with people that are like you or you're comfortable with or your group, so whatever that means, and then you coming to a professional work environment, often are different. For me, I'm about the same. My family says, you are who you are. And I get kicked under the table because if it's an elephant in the room, I'm going to call them out. And I can't be messy. They've said that on occasion. Mm-hmm. Stop being messy. But at the end
of
it,
there's a street slang and lingo that you're capable of using if you wanted to.
Right. I can communicate with any level within an organization, from the C-suite to someone that's managing our parks grass,
mm-hmm.
Manicuring the grass and caretaker. So, you know, just the thing for me is the ability to be able to understand through the book how white people experience white fragility, but it just reinforced what I already knew for me. It was kind of like a light bulb moment where, oh, okay, that's why. And
Lionel and I laughed about this. You know, I did an experiment after reading the book. I just left the book sitting on my table in my office in plain view, nothing around it. So it was very obvious.
I thought it was funny. Yeah. I was wishing he had audio taped or videotaped people
playing over
in,
the speakers.
Right, playing over, watching people's facial expression, trying to not look at the book, looking away and then looking at the book and looking away.
Because that title is, you know, pokes you right in the eye.
Right.
White Fragility. I mean, so there's the book, there's that title. And it was interesting as people walked into the office, clearly saw the book, those that would ask about it, those that would look at it and then quickly look away. Those that would pick it up, some people would ask, what's it about? Some people would want to have conversation. Some people saw the title and clearly never wanted to touch the conversation.
That's like you have an X-rated magazine just lying on
here. Right. Well, you know, at the end of the day, this White Fragility book isn't the first book of its
mm-hmm.
kind.
Right.
It probably won't be the last. It will impact a percentage of white people who will take it and say, I need to look at myself, but a vast majority won't. It's just another book that they look at, well, that's her point of view. I don't have the same point of view as she has. So, because to look internally and to do research is work. And some white people say, well, why do I even need to do this? This isn't going to benefit me in any kind of way, so I'm not doing it. I mean, that's the reality yeah. that we live in. I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't end or comment about that thinking that this is going to change the world and we'll be a wonderful society.
Come on, right. Hear the music playing in the background line now. You know
right.
you do too.
Right. I hope that's the case. But the reality is this is work. This mm-hmm. this is what people of color deal with daily, because when they walk into the room and there's no one in there that looks like them, they have to work through their own self-doubt about how they got to that place in time. Are they confident in their ability to do whatever it is that they were brought into that room to do? Most people don't. White people don't have to take all of that into the room with them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's where the individualism comes in. They come in, well, I'm this. And so they're more about themselves. For people of color, they're carrying in a bunch of other people. Family, their racial group, whomever they are. And that's a lot of pressure. And until, as a society, we're able to have those conversations about we value you based on just who you are, we're going to always be challenged with this.
One of my interesting takeaways from the book was that white people in general don't tend to think about what their own whiteness entails. We'll
right.
think about other races, but right. we don't really think about ourselves categorically.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I have noticed when white people recount a story and describe someone and say there are multiple cultural people in the story, white people don't say it was a white guy that and this, but they will describe, and it was a black guy that was there, and
yeah.
it
yes.
was an Asian guy, but they will never say a white person.
Mm-hmm.
They leave you with the assumption, well, I guess that was a white person, because
right.
they never
yeah.
described it, but they did describe the black person and the Asian person, and which is, to me, the funniest thing. I'll often walk away from those conversations
wonder what
it
that
up,
person?
Saying, I guess, you know, they don't see themselves as a group.
Right.
All these other groups they describe mm-hmm. in the story.
Yeah.
And it's often I've asked, so can you describe who the other person's other
and they'll
people
do like
are?
Hair color, height, not skin color.
It's the funniest thing to me. And
yeah.
and so when people talk about this whole white privilege thing, why white people, and that's why most get defensive about it, is those kinds of suggestions and scenarios that come mm-hmm. up where if a black person has the same conversation and they're describing an incident and there are differing groups of people culturally in that story, they're going to tell you there were white people, there were Asian people, there were black people, but white people won't do that. And it's because you don't see yourselves as a group, because that's just the way it is, and which is kind mm-hmm. of funny to me. I think.
Oh no, yeah. I'll right. I'll go ahead and take off some of the identifying information.
Okay.
Just say a person in my life once got upset because in a Bruno Mars song they said, "Is it Michelle Pfeiffer that white gold?"
White gold, and, right,
and,
right, right.
And they were just like, it seems really offensive, like that they're just like, and I was just like, how is it offensive? They say white gold. That's very nice. And it was just this idea, because that person has definitely just been like, black people,
right.
Asian people, but then someone literally just says white gold and they're just like, well, I don't understand why. Wait, she's not just her race. And I'm just like,
right,
really?
Right. And, but that is that whole privilege piece
yeah.
where I don't have to describe myself as mm-hmm. as a group.
Yeah.
I am what is everything else is compared to.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, I mean, just this whole melting pot mindset where I remember in my diversity training days, I used to talk about the melting pot. And what part of that presentation kind of delved into, the melting pot was okay up until a point. But if you were European,
right.
Italian, German, whatever.
Irish. Yep.
You may have gone through 20 years of the adjustment of being treated as other, but you were easily
assimilated
into the melting pot. If you came from South Africa, Jamaica, anywhere where there were primarily people of color, you could come to the country, but you weren't going to assimilate like the rest because you weren't white.
Right.
Yeah, and I think she touches on that in the book. And that's something that I actually talked about, because you do hear about the struggles of the immigrants.
Right.
And I even used that in talking, you know, previously about, you know, when you fully matriculated into society, you don't have a need for an Irish American Day or, you know, whatever those other days would be. And I think she talks about that. But it's easy. It's easier for those groups of people, as you said, especially the European backgrounds, because when they're walking down the street and you don't know them, they're white. I mean, you don't see them as Irish. You don't see them as German. They're white.
Right. And so they have assimilated. They are white people.
Right. How about for you, Kevin? Any takeaways?
No, I think we've covered, you know, most of them that were in the book. I really did like the continuum to kind of understand. It's not a yes or no question. It's a where are we in this scale of relativity. To me, it was more about... You're right, Lionel. It's not the only book. It wasn't the first book. But I think there was enough punch in the book for me to make me stop, look, question, have conversation, kind of ask myself where I was. But it's been the first step in reading other books and getting other perspectives as well. Because her perspective is fine for her.
Yeah.
I don't call it the be-all, end-all.
Right.
No more than if I wrote a book, it's not the be-all, end-all. But there's been other books and other perspectives. What was the one?
Between the World and Me?
Yeah. Interesting book, black author, very accomplished author. And it's too easy to read that book as he's writing. The book is a story to his son, or a letter to his son. And he's describing all of his challenges. And of course, part of my mind is going, well, okay, you're an award-winning author. You've got 6A books. You're pretty well-to-do. You've got this house. What are you doing talking about all this stuff? He still has lived through this,
right.
And he's overcome in spite of, right?
Right.
You know, but the part I think we were talking about is all that is well and good, but if he gets pulled over at 2 o'clock in the morning and he's sitting in the car and a cop's coming up to the window, he probably isn't seen as an award-winning author.
Right.
He's seen as a black male, and his fear of what that is and what it could entail is very real.
Right, right. You can't deny that as a life experience, and so... Doesn't matter your culture. We were talking about Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah.
And it was like Kevin's comment in passing, he's worth millions of dollars. I said, well, yeah. He's an accomplished basketball player and has won championships. But at 2 o'clock in the morning on a dark road, he's just a big, tall black guy.
Yeah.
And so there are often people who carry those guns, they don't watch basketball. They may be soccer watchers or whatever.
Right.
And so he just...
Luckily, he's got enough money that he's got a blinking sign around his neck that says, hey, I'm Shaquille O'Neal.
Right, right. Or it's on his on his license plate, I'm sure.
Shaq Daddy.
Shaq Daddy, right.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for bringing a thought-provoking book.
And being a good example of actually trying to sit down and have important conversations with people. Especially people that you care about and you want to feel comfortable.
To the white people out there listening, I would say get past the title. You're not going to like that title, White Fragility. It's going to make you immediately defensive. But take step one. You know, read the book. Hopefully it'll cause you to stop and think. Hopefully, as Lionel says, you know your history. Hopefully it'll get you to read more, explore more. A lot of good is going to come of the conversations. I don't know if we can change the world, but to even look at the conversation the four of us are having here, there's parts about even our city that we can change.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm going to link with this episode our previous episode from April of this
book
year.
List? Yeah.
Yes. It was our anti-racist reading companion book list.
Yes. Mm.
In case anybody is thirsty for more.
Yeah.
And stay tuned next week for more fantastic book recommendations.
Bye.